Hello and welcome to the Retro Asylum, the UK's number one retro gaming podcast show. I'm here with Chris O'Regan. Hello, Chris.
Hello.
And unfortunately, not Mads. He couldn't join us today. Mads, as he mentioned on our last show, has had a lot going on over the past few weeks in his personal life. And I think his time, because this is a game. We're going to be talking about Tower of Doom. That was our Game Club game for January. And it's fair to say it's not a game that you can really experience anything of unless you are prepared to put in the hard yards.
Absolutely.
I think yes. That'd be fair to say.
I was going to follow on with something, but I'll just leave it there.
You just hold your fire, Mr. O'Regan.
Yeah, I'm so keen. But just like to point out that we are both called Chris, and both one's a former host and a current host of Retro Asylum. It's a bit like Doctor Who. It's like, you know. So, yeah, it's like the two Doctors or the two Chrises.
There we are. If only there was a way that we could have two Doctors together. Well, this is it. People don't need that. They've got the two Chrises together.
Two Chrises together.
On a pod.
Not sure if they're going to entertain it, but never mind. Sorry, everyone.
So, Mads, we miss you. Yeah. And we hope you're very well. Yeah. And we both look forward to speaking to you very soon. Mads did manage to get, because this will come out after our shortlist episode for the February Game Club, which Mads did manage to find some time to record with our patron supporter, Mark Billund. And that is choosing some SNES run and gun games for February.
Is there so few of those?
Are there?
No.
I was going to say.
That's sarcasm, that was. Being sarcastic. So,
well,
yeah.
They did manage to choose four, actually, that aren't games. The games I've heard of, but I'm not massively familiar with any of them.
I'm not hugely familiar with the SNES / SNES.
No.
Depending on what part of the world you come from. That console. Because I didn't own one back in the day, I was very much a PC game or Amiga person at the time, and then I went to the PC when Doom arrived, because we all did.
Who didn't?
Don't judge.
So, who didn't?
I just love discovering them, because the library of that machine is formidable.
Yeah.
Just like the Mega Drive, but that's a discussion for another time.
The best, potentially? Objectively? Or is it the greatest library of any platform ever?
No, because Mega Drive's got Shining Force on it. So
tis true.
Sorry. Yeah, told to pop that bubble, my friend.
The SNES for me is...
And Snatcher. So
it's... ish.
Well, that's a Mega CD.
With an add-on, so yes.
Is that another platform? I believe it is, but now
that's just cheating. No, for me, it's a Super Mario World and RPG machine. And
like I said, I just present to you as evidence... Shining Force, and then we just move on. And then there's Phantasy Star. What? Where do you want me to stop at this point?
Let's stop there. Otherwise, this podcast will be taken into the 16-bit wars territory. We don't want to go
there. And also, with the two Chrises, what are you going to do? That's the point. Our tastes are very similar, as you'll discover later on in this show.
I know. We need to find a point of difference, I think. We will come to that. Yeah. Anyway, in time-honoured tradition, which hasn't changed since you walked these hallowed walls of time past, Chris O'Regan, what have you been up to?
Well, apart from, you know, some modern gaming stuff, because, you know, Animal Crossing, although that game's not a game, it's more a thing you do as part of your chores, so that's a side thing.
Are you still playing that?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. How many hours now?
I've no idea, but I only play about 20 minutes a day, because that's all I need to do. Mm. Do some weeding, chat to the neighbours. So that's exactly what I do.
What a phenomenon.
Have a coffee with Brewster. He's lovely.
Yeah.
And it's all good. But no, it's therapeutic. That's why I do it. It's therapeutic. Mm. It's genuinely. And then I'm wading my way through Assassin's Creed Odyssey, because that's like the massive sandwich that a Homer Simpson had. You know, he's munching his way through that. That's what that's what those games are like. You just play them and it just keeps, you know, it doesn't really.
Yeah.
But then retro stuff, two things. First of all, I do every now and again do a little survey and making sure my things are working, and also felt compelled to have a look at some things.
Yeah.
And I thought, oh, I haven't looked at my VIC-20s in a while. I'm sure they're fine.
Yeah.
I have two. Don't know why I do. So, okay, I'll better check those then. So I did. And what did I check them with? Well, two games. Well, the principal game, which is related to what you're looking at, was Grid Runner.
Yeah.
That's a magnificent game that still holds up even after 40 years of being released.
Yeah.
So that's lovely. And I played that for a bit. It's basically Centipede, only a bit mental.
Yeah.
And really, 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 really difficult.
Yeah.
And then the other game I played was, not many people talk about this, but I have often mentioned it, is Jetpack.
Mm.
It does need an 8K expansion minimum, but I think it actually runs. I mean, I ran it on my 16K expansion. Again, things I was testing on the machine, making sure it's all working, and it does. Fantastic. Port.
Yeah, it's a great port. Yeah, it's a great version.
Really, really good version. It's not quite up there with the original specy version, but
it's not. It doesn't quite.
It's way too big.
It's a great. I mean, for what the VIC-20 is, it's a wonderful version.
Yeah. And yeah, that's pretty much it. And then the other game I played is Saboteur Deep Cover, which is a bonus I got from getting the Crash Annual over the Christmas period.
Yeah.
And then I got a tape through the post earlier this week. I went, what's this? Oh, there it is. And I loaded it on my Next, because my Spectrum Next is my default Spectrum. Call me a heretic, all you like, but it's my default machine for my Speccy. Although I have all the other models as well, because of course I do.
Of course you do. You must.
But I must, yeah. But I do, even the toaster. Yeah, toast rack. Yeah. Got one of those. I loaded it up, not expecting what it is, because sadly I didn't do enough research. But when I finished sort of researching, it's basically Saboteur in the Saboteur universe from that fantastic game, which on reflection was way ahead of its time.
Was.
Although I didn't really get on with Saboteur 2.
No.
Sorry, Clive.
Is that the one that's set on the island, is it?
Yeah. I think it was like, you know, jumping the shark a bit. Anyway, this is a text adventure.
Is it?
Yeah. Wasn't expecting that.
Interesting.
And not only that, I got on quite well with it, but the problem is that it's a real-time text adventure, and that sometimes you get attacked or things attack you.
Yeah.
And like, oh, I've got to react. So thankfully, I just save-scummed it because you can.
Because you
just hit the button on the side and go, right, I'm just going to freeze it here and save the state here, because that's what you do.
So is it a Spectrum Next game, or are you just...
No, it's a 128. So
okay.
I loaded it on, because I have a tape deck hooked up to my Next, because of course you do.
Yeah, tradition.
I have it hooked up. So then I basically loaded the game on from the tape, and that took about good 15 minutes. Now, you may think, no, Spectrum games only take 5. You're right if they're 48K.
Exactly.
They're not. 128s, they take a long time.
Yeah, there's more to load in, man.
So much so that I actually had the same amount of time doing that while putting away my laundry. There you go, a bit of like input into my dynamic life here.
But you know what's brilliant about that, and I do exactly the same thing when I'm emulating traditional speccies on my Next, is you don't need to do that, of course. Do you? You don't need to. You could just fast load and instantly play.
No. In this instance, I only had an audio tape. I had to do
it. Of course you didn't have the tap file, did you?
No.
Yeah, you did actually have the physical tape. Yeah,
I had
so
the
you could...
audio, like regular monologue, the sort of monologue, like, you know, analog tape. There's only one way of getting it in there. And
true.
That was from regular. So I had no option there, my friend.
But do you find yourself, when you do have the option, letting it just load... Anyway, emulating the load-in.
Very, very, very rarely.
Do you?
It depends.
Maybe I'm just
time
old.
Is too precious.
Yeah.
Most of the time, no. Sometimes I do it out of curiosity, see what the loading screen was like.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you never see it. You're never going to see it. But most of the time, no. So in this instance, I had to. And also, by the way, as soon as it loaded, I immediately did a snapshot. I went, there you go. I'm not doing that again.
Yeah, well, did you?
Yeah. But the point is, you know, the loading screen was fantastic, magnificent.
Yeah.
I mean, we're talking 21st century loading screen, not 1980s. So it's just all the dipple effect and the stuff that they do now, just astonishing. Brilliant stuff. Really good stuff. And even had like, you know, two loading screens. So the first loading screen was Fusion because they're the publishers.
Yeah.
And the second loading screen was the game itself. Very impressive.
Fabulous.
So yeah. So, oh no, it was great. But like I said, I had laundry to do.
And of course, in 15 minutes, you've got plenty of time for two loading screens to load in and display.
Also complied with the regulation. That is, don't whatever you do, stay in the same room while the thing is loading. Otherwise, it won't load.
Yes. It's so true. Because if you watch the screen, it's inevitable. You're going to get an error. It will happen. Them's are the rules.
Them's the rules, especially on the 81. The 81 is very temperamental when it comes to loading.
I bet you it is. Yeah, but that is old tech.
Very old tech. All of which I still have and it still works. Anyway, so that's me. What about you, Chris? Other Chris is really frustrating and confusing.
So Chris V1. I mentioned on the Sensible Soccer episode, which feels like it wasn't that long ago because it wasn't, because we were very late recording that. It was only 2 weeks ago, that I had parted with some cash to acquire an MSX2. Which I've always wanted. I got an MSX a couple of years ago when I was at the revival before the dreaded leg descended.
Before the dark times. Oh, no.
Yeah. So I did manage to get an MSX1, but I've always wanted the MSX2 because there's one game on there that I've always wanted to experience on real hardware, and that is Metal Gear. And this ties into our lifelong community playthrough that we will be playing forever as we go through pretty much every game ever made on certainly every game ever made from, a lot of Nintendo stuff and Metal Gear. Metal Gear is a series coming up after we've played Metroid, which is our current game. And I've always wanted to play it on real hardware. I've always wanted to play the MSX2 version. So our good friends of the show and Discord member and patron, Muppets4 is his Discord name, Hans Krombein. He is a Dutch guy, and he pointed me at a Dutch version of eBay, really. It's called Marktplaats. Apologies, Hans, if I've absolutely mullered that pronunciation. But it's an online marketplace, and obviously the MSX and the MSX2 is very big in the Netherlands, and he gave me a link to an MSX2 that was being sold, Philips MSX2, and I bought it. I even corresponded with the seller in Dutch. Get me using liberal use of Google Translate.
So that's knowing the strange Monty Python sketch about bad translation books always scares the Jesus out of me. But look it up. It's just ridiculous. It involves one sentence as my nipples explode with the light. I'm sure you didn't say that to him.
I hope it didn't. Whatever happened.
You know what it meant. Like, okay, that's nice for you.
Well done. But I'm selling an MSX2, and that's nothing to do with what you just said.
Nothing to do with what you just said. Okay, well, I think I'll just like doing a... Anyway, but no, that's magnificent, because I've wanted an MSX2 for many years. Mm. I haven't just never... Everyone I've encountered is normally riddled with Japanese characters and all sorts of things.
Exactly, like, yeah, you've got to be careful.
Or Arabic characters.
Yeah, there's a lot of that as well.
And I'm thinking, that's not really what I'd... Because my rule so far has been throughout is, was it released in the UK? And the answer is no, then I won't get it. Now, it's the problem with MSX2 is they never released it in the UK. As far as I'm aware, I'm sure there's going to be people going, oh, thank you, I'll find. But as far as I'm aware, it was never formally released in this country.
I'm not sure.
And which means it's difficult for me to justify. But the problem is the MSX2 has some magnificent games on it.
It sure does.
They really, and there's recent games, like within the last 5 years, they really make it sing.
Yeah.
I'm jealous a little bit. Because
there's a guy called...
Have you got it yet?
I've got it. It's behind me in what looks like a shotgun case.
Right.
It's not though. I had to convince my wife when I unboxed it. It came in a nicely packaged box from the Netherlands, and I unboxed it and took it out. And my wife actually, she said, "Is that a gun?" I said, "No, it's not a gun."
No.
I said, "No, it's much more exciting than that. It's an MSX2." At that point, she wandered away. Shaking her head. What I've also managed to get is a flash cart for it, because It came with a bunch of floppies, this MSX2. So I was quite excited because I'd already ordered the flash card.
I bet that's going to work.
Well, the disk drive does not sound healthy.
No, of course it doesn't.
But I have no idea what an MSX2 disk drive should sound like, but I'm pretty sure it shouldn't sound like the way mine sounds.
Right, okay.
Because it really does sound bad. And I stuck a floppy in there, and I didn't realize 3.5-inch floppies, just like the Amiga. Stuck one of the MSX floppies in that came with it, some original games and some original utilities, stuck it in, and it kind of whirred for about 5 minutes, really unhealthy sounding whir, and then just kind of piece it out.
So have you tried cleaning the heads yet?
No, not yet.
So that's the first thing you do. That actually solves 7 out of 10 problems.
Yeah.
And then you'll find, if that doesn't work,
drive belt.
It's a drive belt issue. Yeah. And then if that doesn't work, it's the dreaded, oh, look, one of the cogs is disintegrated.
Yes.
At which point you have to replace the drive with something else. You might be able to get a GoTek for it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, there are GoTeks doing the rounds online for the MSX.
But no, it has two cartridge ports, does it not?
No, just one.
You've been shafted.
I'm pretty sure it's just one. I can't remember.
I thought they have two. I might be wrong. Anyway, but you got a SD card reader. Tell us about that.
Yes. So this was, it's called the MX Flash Cart and ROM. And there's a site called the MSX Card Shop where they do sell some modern games, original card games, modern games, all legit, homebrew titles. They're about 25, 30 euros each. But they do also have a flash cart, which comes with, there's all kinds of different models. The one that I got also has 512K of RAM on board as well. So it's a nice little upgrade, which you need for some of the more modern homebrew stuff. You need the extra RAM on board.
You do.
So that felt like quite an investment. It was as much as the computer itself, again. So they're not cheap. But the way I felt was I can either have this system and really not use it, or I can have a library of games open to me and use it. And
yeah,
also,
getting the carts for those is difficult now. Wasn't in the back in the day, but
well, also you have to import them, and that's part of the problem. Is a lot of this.
Oh, okay.
So these carts that I've got, this is coming from Spain.
Oh, the SD card reader. Yeah,
the SD card. But I was
talking about the regular carts.
But I imagine there's not a lot of UK sellers who are selling these original carts now.
Be surprised.
Maybe
they were quite prevalent back in the day.
It's £500 for a boxed MSX2 on eBay is about the going rate. 450 to 600.
Right. Okay.
It's expensive.
That's it. That's twice. That's two Amiga 500s right there.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's probably every model of Speccy as well.
Yeah. Yeah.
It pretty
probably
much
is, yeah.
But it works. And as far as I can tell, it works. It's, the video output works. So I'm hoping that the car port will be just fine, and I'll be able to use it, which will be swell.
Yeah, yeah, the MSX2 has a GUI interface with the card. The MSX1, which I know you have, you should definitely put it in that as well. Until it's not as intuitive. You have to use DOS commands to actually access it. There's no UI at all. It's all just DOS, which is a bit counterintuitive. You have to select drives. And
so have you already done this then?
I've got a same with one as you, but I bought it many years ago, but it's for my MSX1.
Okay.
And so that's why I've played a lot of games, like Penguin Adventure, for example, which is one of the earliest Kojima games ever made, and a fantastic game written. It's got him written all over it. You can tell. There's some weird stuff goes on in Penguin Adventure. Trust me. Also, pro tip, if you've got an MSX, it recognises two buttons.
Yeah.
A lot of games require two buttons. I know Metal Gear definitely does.
Yeah.
So you need a joystick that has two unique buttons. So what I would do is get a Mega Drive filter for it and then use one of those.
Yeah.
And they don't cost very much at all.
No. But I was reading online that, because it's a 9-pin port, isn't it? But you need to have the
filter.
It needs to be modded or you need to have a kind of a adapter.
It's like the C64.
Adapter.
I'm not sure if it busts it like the C64 does, but I do have a filter for my C64, so I play a lot of games on the C64 with the Mega Drive controller, much to the chagrin of many. I don't care. So, Iridium with the Mega Drive is amazing, so shut it. So Sorry, I'm not going to go on that rant. Honestly, D-pad on 8-bit games, thumbs up. Yeah. Saying.
And then the other thing really I've been up to is in the spirit of what you've just said about getting stuff out and making sure that they work, since my Next arrived, I've not plugged in my ZX Spectrum 2, which is the only model of Speccy I have. So I wanted to play some Jeff Minter games because I'm going to be appearing alongside you again. You're going to be sick of the sight of me because I've been invited onto the Cane and Rinse episode for Jeff Minter.
Yeah.
So you'll be sick of the sound of my voice, Chris.
I know.
Which is unfortunate for you, really. So I wanted to play some of the early Jeff Minter games on a Speccy. And I thought, well, I could play it on the Next, but I haven't had the ZX Spectrum out for a while. So I got that out. And I've been very much enjoying the some of the early, really early Jeff Minter games in all of 48K at most.
Nice.
Earlier games.
He did his C16 game, you know.
Yeah, he did. Yeah, one of the very few people who...
C16 games. There's not many good guns on that machine. No. Sorry, everyone.
So that would have been...
On.
Was that some kind of form of deflex, was it?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, he wrote deflex about 8 times for various platforms in various iterations. But a lot of his games are still very playable today.
Yeah.
Simple and playable and, yeah, very elegantly written, in my opinion.
Good one. And PS4 is amazing.
Yes, why not? Keep it going, Jeff.
Keep it going.
Don't ever stop. We also actually met in person and played some board games, which was a fabulous way to spend the Sunday afternoon.
Yeah, we don't worry, we won't bore for the listeners because, you know, as soon as you say the word board games or tabletop, it's like,
what? Skip.
Like, skip.
Fast forward 15 seconds.
We won't, but we did play some co-op. We played a co-op game, played a deck builder.
Yeah.
See, look, they're skipping already. Stop. Make them stop. So I'm going to stop.
No,
there's a whole different realm. Some people are interested about it, I found when I start jabbering away, but vast majority of our audience know.
Yeah. But it's very enjoyable.
It was lovely.
Very enjoyable. Let's go on to some news.
News,
Now,
what's happened?
This is not really retro news, but it feels remiss if we didn't mention it. Activision Blizzard.
Yeah, the acquisition by Microsoft. When that happened, Jeff Gerstmann from Giant Bomb, I think it was him, immediately went, right, when are we going to get River Raid? Come on.
I love that. Are we going to get Pitfall 3?
We want River Raid, updated. And I'm totally up for that. Like, just can we have a new River Raid? Because that's still my go-to game on the Atari 8-bits, one of the best ports
it
they
is.
Did. Because it's a cartridge, you just jam it in and off you go.
Yes.
Although it's the same now because we've got SD card readers. That's not the point. You know, you just jam it in and it's just such a fantastic game.
Game Pass day one. River Raid.
Definitely.
Here we go.
River Raid.
Come on.
No change, by the way. Same game. Just
give us the ROM, put it on Game Pass and we're happy.
We're happy. It is the most colourful Atari 2600 game ever made.
It's still very, very playable
as well. It's like the early blue sky sort of stuff. Not quite as blue as Whitewater, but I'm still not bitter.
Yeah. I do struggle with the 2600, actually going back to those games. I do struggle. But River Raid is still very playable.
Yeah. I've now been delving into a bit of 2600 stuff recently. I didn't mention it at the top of the show before I was doing it for other reasons, but, you know, because I had to repair mine because the power supply at the back was not working properly. I had to resolder it because all the solder points are cracked. I couldn't see because it's micro cracks, but I just basically resoldered them and jobs are good. They're very robust machines. But, yeah, I hear what you say, but when you play them again, you find other things from them. It's interesting. But you just got to keep cracking on. That's what I've found. Don't play them for 20 minutes. Try an hour. Then you'll get something out of them.
Good advice.
Yeah.
We'll come back to this later about whether games of that era do actually hold up in the context of Tower of Doom. But hold that thought.
But yeah, in interesting times. Consolidation, is that a good thing? I don't think so.
No, I don't think so. But I also don't think that allowing Activision Blizzard to carry on in the way they were was a good thing either.
No, that was abhorrent.
Microsoft is also not without its problems, of course.
Have you used Word recently? Sorry, that was wrong.
In terms of its culture, but yeah, I think a change was very much required. What does it mean for the games industry? Well, we'll see. We were having a conversation with Steve Erickson, who of course works for Sony, in the light of Sony's plummeted, I suppose, the inevitable plummet in Sony's share price following the news coming out. And for how long we can expect to see Call of Duty on PlayStation, who knows? They're saying all the right things.
I just look at Minecraft and go, they've owned that for over a decade now, I think.
Yeah.
And they still put it on every platform known to man.
Yeah.
So I don't see a problem with that. Call of Duty is a force unto itself. I still play Call of Duty games. Sorry.
Yeah.
If you like. But I actually quite like the single player campaigns when they exist.
Yeah.
Wasn't too keen on Vanguard and Reflection, but it was there.
Yeah.
But there's modern games again. Sorry, everyone. And that was on the PlayStation 5 as well. Oh, but should we just get our coats?
But it is something which will have, I think it will have a big shift. Microsoft need it because their sales are lagging significantly behind the PlayStation, despite...
Oh, you mean Microsoft Game Studios needs it? Yes.
Yeah, Microsoft as a video game thing
needs
it.
There you go, thank you. Yeah. Yes. Because I remember a time before the Xbox, the original Xbox, I'm that old, when Microsoft had no interest in games at all.
No, yeah.
I mean, just vehemently had no interest in it.
It was only 25 years ago.
Yeah, to the point where, you know, they actually had to hide a game in a spreadsheet.
Yeah.
This is the flight simulator that was hidden in a version of Excel. Can't remember which one. They had to hide it. whereas now they're spending $70 billion on almost 70 billion, sorry, 68 billion, something like that. Mm. It's an obscene amount of money for a game. It's just absurd. You know, if you told me that 25 years ago, I was like, strange person.
Yeah.
Anyway, but there it is.
25 years later, they splashed $70 billion.
Although it would have
games.
Been a lot cheaper 25 years ago.
Yes.
Activision.
Exactly.
Because that was pre-COD and all sorts of stuff. So they were just doing MechWarrior back then. Anyway.
Big news, though, indeed. More news, but not necessarily big news. The what feels like the perpetual saga of Sega's demise into some kind of obscurity continues. I mean, it was a bit of a misnomer, I think. Earlier in the week, the news broke that the headline was Sega exits the arcade business after 56 years. I'm not really sure Sega was still in the arcade business last week, before this news broke. But what they did have, I believe, is their name outside various game centers around Japan. They actually sold 81% of their arcade business in 2020. This was just the remaining 19% of that business. But the Sega game centers will now be rebranded. So is this the end of Sega's association with arcades? Possibly. They leave a legacy behind of many, 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 many classics. And who knows where Sega goes from here? They're going to focus on their games publishing, but it's certainly not the Sega that we knew and loved from 30, 35 years ago, is it? And
no,
probably
it's
never will
not
be.
Quite as bad as Atari, which isn't Atari anymore.
No,
to the point where they're now merging loot boxes with the thing that ought not be. You know, the three letter acronym might have a T in it somewhere. I'm not going to say it. No.
Not safe for podcasting. No.
No, it's not. Because the algorithms get search engines and then we all get in trouble.
Yeah, but we don't know what we're talking about according to Ubisoft, do we? So
no, we don't. No, apparently not. There's a company that's a bastion of a barometer of you know, what's going on.
Exactly.
Moving swiftly on.
Yeah. So just a quick line for people who don't know. If you have ordered a Steam Deck, you must check your inbox. If you were one of the lucky ones that got in there and you got the base model, so the model with the smallest memory, they're going to be shipping next month. So it's the 30th of January. Check your inbox every Friday from the 25th of February because you're going to have... 72 hours, I think, to confirm your order and purchase.
That's right, yeah.
Machine.
Also, just to be clear, the rest of us who are a bit greedy.
Yeah, we have to wait.
Went, oh, I went for the middle one. Most people I know went for the middle one.
Yeah.
Because the last one was just like, that's just opulent and nonsense. So I just went for the middle one. But unfortunately, that turns out it's Q2. It's almost as bad as my nano machine, which I'm not going to mention because that means I didn't say the M word, so you can't take a drink, listener. But, you know, I'm still waiting on that.
Yeah.
Hopefully next week.
But Q2 is what, from 1st of April onwards? So it's not that long.
No, it's not. I mean, I've got patience. And anyway, that's just after PAX East, so it'd be great.
Yeah. Oh, wouldn't that be nice?
Wouldn't that be nice? Come off the plane. Oh, there it is.
But what Valve have said is check your junk, check your non-focused inbox. Oh, right, do it every Friday because the plan will be, unless they change their minds, they're going to issue the emails on a Friday. So just keep refreshing that inbox.
Check your junk every Friday.
Yeah. That's, and I know
really good.
I know a good few of our Discord members have them reserved. So don't forget. Antstream, Chris, are you an Antstream member?
Massively. I love this system.
Yeah. Did I see that I think Game Boy games?
Apparently, yeah. I haven't delved into it yet, but I play a lot of arcade games on Antstream.
Yeah.
Because they're great to dump into, and I love the Tapper on it recently.
They've had a competition on that recently, haven't they?
Yeah. That's why I was playing it. It's good. I'm rubbish at it, but I still love playing it, and it really works really well, especially on a PC with a wired connection, like low latency.
Yeah.
But I have used my Fire Stick as well. I had to have a Fire Stick, which, by the way, is completely legit. I don't actually use any of the hacking stuff on it. I just use it as a regular thing.
No, I've never owned a Fire Stick.
But it's there, and it's hooked up to a telly that allows me to play arcade games, and it works okay, but not nearly as good as a PC. But yeah, and stream, big thumbs up.
Yeah,
so good. I'm happy that Game Boy games are arriving, though. I don't know. I didn't really get into them as a kid, so I've got the nostalgia for them.
Yeah. It's another absolutely stupendous library, in my opinion.
Yeah.
But that's good news. And Antstream going from strength to strength. Obviously, they recently added the indie homebrew stuff, didn't they, as well?
Yeah. I mean, I've got to say, on a side note, I do much prefer the Game Boy Color games than the Game Boy.
What? Because you can actually see them. That helps.
But they are actually slightly more complex.
Yeah, they are. They're late 90s as opposed to early and mid 90s.
There's more than just colour added to them, virtually. You know, the Zeldas on the Game Boy Color, very, very good.
Very good.
I've got both of those, oddly enough.
And then the final little tidbit I wanted to mention was the Melchior's Mansion.
Yeah.
Did you see that? It feels like it's been in development. So this is made by a guy called Richard Jordan. I can't remember the name of his company. I'm going to see if I can get it up now. I met this guy, and you might have met him also.
I definitely have. Yeah.
So he was at Revival a few years back, showing off a very early demo of this.
Yeah, it's a proof of concept. It's a beautiful game.
It's brilliant.
And I don't think the next version is ever going to come out, or maybe it is. Oh, I may have misreported that just a moment ago. There's been some flux about whether it's coming out or not.
In the press release, it said the plan is still to take it to the next.
Yes, it is, yeah.
I mean, it's very much
out on the 128.
It's very much a Spectrum-inspired game, isn't it? It's almost like, it looks
I want to get it on the 128 rather than the PC, but it is out on the PC.
Did it? Has it had a 128K release?
I thought it had. I may have just getting it wrong. But I know it's on a 8-bit platform.
Yeah.
But, yeah, the PC version apparently has got limited codes for it. I'm not sure if it's actually available now.
But it looks great. It looks really, really nice. The company is called BitLink Games, and it's been released via Itch. So if you go to itch.io and you search for BitGlint, BitGlint, you'll see it. And it looks... I mean, it looks like those classics, the Ultima Play the Game classics from the 80s. If you imagined a straight line just going north of what those games would have looked like if people had carried on developing those isometric arcade adventures, it looks like this is where you get to if you were in 2022. It is a phenomenal looking game. And according to some of the reviews on it, it plays really well as well. So certainly want to look out for that.
Yeah. Very, very, very. They are making a 128 version. I heard they were making a PC and 128 version, but the next one was up in the air.
Okay.
Because of the lack of audience. Let's put their hands up. There's not many people own them.
No.
And I am one. But there's not that many, and it's the effort required to but whereas a lot more people know 128, and I think just a few more people own PCs.
I would have thought so. Yeah, maybe just one or two.
One or two more
billion. Yeah. But there are going to be more owners of Spectrum next, but probably not until 2023, unfortunately.
No, that's right, because of the old shortages that we're suffering, all of us.
But the reward will be, and we haven't got this on our notes, so I'm kind of making this up from memory, but I think the reward is that they're going to get a more powerful processor within their machines.
Yeah, which is a bit of a problem, because then you split the market.
Well, this is the problem. Yeah,
they shouldn't do that, in my opinion, because I've only got one. Thank you very much.
Well, it's a very small market to begin with.
Yeah.
It's not one that you want to split.
You don't want to split that in half. It's a silly thing to do.
No.
They can do other things like improve the interface or, I don't know, make it easier to mod inside. That's what I would do. If you like, you know, and then that's fine. That's what I would do. Actually make it easier to modify the hardware or something like that. But not what they're suggesting now.
They have some very patient backers.
They do. I was patient as well. I listened to Ed.
Yeah. I wouldn't like to be waiting again, though.
No.
Once was enough.
I mean, it's 2 years now almost. I've owned one.
Yeah.
And I don't regret it for a second.
Yeah. It's
still a remarkable machine. And it's, like I said, it is hooked up.
Yeah.
It's not stored away. It's hooked up to a screen. I can access it all of the time.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah.
It kind of leads us on to our topic.
It does. And let's move on to that topic. Before we do, we always take this time to thank our patrons. I haven't got the list because I didn't ask Dean for the up-to-date list. But a huge thank you to you, Chris, and your co-patrons of Retro Asylum. You are all superbly appreciated by the team. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
Let's get on with it. Because I know you can't wait to talk about Tower of Doom.
Can I, though?
For the Intellivision.
For reasons.
Now, before we get into detail, you are gonna pretend to be Mads for a second.
Okay, well, all right, okay. Gotta be very Danish now.
Because as you know, this is the bit where I say, Mads, tell us what Tower of Doom is. So instead of saying that, I'm going to say, Chris, what is Tower of Doom in a nutshell?
Tower of Doom is a Capcom arcade. Oh, right. No,
no, not that one, the other one.
Yeah. Tower of Doom is an Intellivision that came out very late in its life.
Yeah.
It wasn't released by Mattel because Mattel had walked away from the Intellivision by then. It was released by a company called Int TV in 1987, which is, for my personal thing, is like I'm freaking out at that because by that time I'd got an Atari ST. So
exactly.
Going on.
Yeah.
I was busy, you know, not in Tower of Doom. I was in Dungeon Master running away from that massive dragon.
That's part of its problem, I think, but we'll come to that.
Yeah. So it was originally called Advanced Dungeons and Dragons, the Tower of Mystery.
Yeah.
And it's the third D&D game, in television D&D game, but it was to be the third, but it turns out not.
Yeah.
Because by the time 1987 rolled around, the rights to Dungeons and Dragons were already in a state of flux anyway, looking at UTSR, which no longer exists, or no, it does exist and doesn't exist. But that's a discussion for a completely different podcast. So they had to get rid of that name, and then they turned it into just Tower of Doom.
Yeah.
Now, I'm very familiar with the first two D&D games, way more familiar than I was up until recently to this third iteration. And it had different names as well, like D&D 3, Arcade D&D, Advanced Dungeons & Dragons, Revenge of the Master.
Yeah.
And it started off, it started off work way back in 1983, I think it was.
Yeah.
Where they started working on it.
It was due to come out in 1984, wasn't it?
And it was a follow-up to the first two cartridges, which we haven't mentioned. So Cloudy Mountains, which was spoken about in the club game club.
That episode. Was on your long list, wasn't it?
That was on my trio of games,
yeah.
which didn't have much water in it, unlike the other one. And then there was this one, Treasures of Tarmin.
Yeah.
Now, I did mention, actually, I think I might have mentioned it in passing.
Yeah, we did.
But Treasures of Tarmin is basically basically similar to, it's a 3D game, first-person 3D game.
Yeah.
And you're going around a maze not a maze, a dungeon, killing monsters, finding treasure, opening doors, going up and down levels, and getting out and not dying.
Yeah.
Fantastic game.
Mm.
Has all the colors, the stuff that we're going to talk about later on, has all of that. Really a bit like Wizardry, you know, those games.
Exactly.
On the PC, it's very similar to that. And we've got some notes here, and this is a bit too complex. No, it's way too complex for most audience, but a lot of Intellivision games were quite complex. So, it's, you know, it's fine. But it really was a hard sell, because when you sat, unless you really knew, read the manual and sat down and were patient with it, it was almost impenetrable.
Yeah.
So that's, you know, always got to read the manual for that particular game. Otherwise, it's just, but there's a great Twitch streamer that does Intellivision games, and I recommend that. He does a really, I can't remember his name now, put it in the show notes, but he does a really good job of demonstrating how this game is played.
Okay.
It's astonishing.
Yeah.
A chap called Dan Bass decided to take on the mantle of actually bringing on a third game, like an arcade D&D.
And they wanted it to be, I think back, Mattel decided that they wanted it to be, after they felt Treasure of Tarmin was too complicated. So the brief for the original development team was, now we want this to be arcade D&D essentially. You know, I'm thinking, see, when I hear that, I think, well, you know, are you talking about a gauntlet style game? You know, that a real arcade style game? Because I wouldn't say this was arcadey in the slightest. Maybe more arcadey, you could say, perhaps. I don't know.
Well, that's the problem. It's a mashup between two games.
Yeah, I agree.
That later.
Yeah, it's between the stools in some ways.
Yeah, well, they tried to take the best bits out of the previous two games, but unfortunately, they chose the wrong bit.
So they brought in, when NTV Corp had acquired Mattel, the business of Mattel and the Intellivision rights, etc., as you said, the license had lapsed. Then they brought in a different development team to finish it off. Finish it off they did. And it was ultimately released in early 1987, 3 years after it was originally intended to be released. When it's fair to say things have moved on.
Just a bit. Like I said, the ST had arrived. 16-bit machines have arrived. Also, at the... the 8-bit consoles were still going strong. I mean, the NES was dominant.
Yeah.
In North America. The mantle of work was taken on by John Tomlinson, who worked on Mission X, and the graphics were done by Connie Goldman. Got a lot to thank her.
Yeah.
She did amazing, amazing work.
Yeah.
Worked on Thundercast.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it looks really, really, really good.
And these were started originally by Mattel, by Monique Lujan Bakarink.
Yeah,
and Carl Morris. So yeah, lots of good names there.
Yeah,
And it's a attempt at doing a dungeon crawler, which had already been done on the Intellivision. So why do it again?
Roguelike,
but it's a It genuinely is rogue. It genuinely is absolutely. Yeah. It's a pure rogue. It's not a like. It's a rogue.
Okay, so it's a rogue clone.
It's rogue. Yeah. Yeah, definitely it's a rogue clone.
So I've never played Rogue. So let's just talk about that for a sec. So I mean, well, I was reading that Rogue also has the colour. I don't know whether it kind of lifts the colour thing directly from Rogue, but Rogue also has the element of colours attributable to weapons.
The point is that you can't save.
No,
and
that's a huge problem.
You just keep going and going until it ends.
Yeah,
and then you get points at the end. If you see how, you know, do you and you reach a point of momentum where, or a point of equilibrium where you're more powerful than everything else around you.
Yes,
and you just start monstering everything and munching your way through until it ends.
Until you reach a thing where you don't, and then you die, and then it ends.
Then you die. Then it ends.
Yeah.
So there's those two ways of doing it, but this is a rogue, in all but name.
Okay.
And Rogue been traditional, though, it's far more complex. There's a lot more going on because it can, because it's on a mainframe computer, as it was, rather than a rather sort of simplistic console, second-generation console. Even though the Intellivision is a mite more powerful than the 2600, it wasn't nearly as powerful as the ColecoVision.
Yeah.
and order of scales, everyone. But it's that neatly in between.
Yeah,
in between.
So let's just talk in terms of overview. So Tower of Doom is essentially, as you've said, it's a rogue clone. It's essentially a maze game. You start off, you choose a predefined character, and we'll break all of this down in more detail in a sec, but you choose a predefined character, you take on a predetermined game, if you like. There are several game modes or missions, and they each do things slightly differently, and you are plunged into a series of mazes. You start at the top of a tower, and you work your way through each level of that tower, picking up weapons, picking up treasure, defeating monsters. And the aim is to find the stairs and ultimately make it to the foot of the tower. And if you are successful, you see your little man running from the door out to freedom. Now, there is one difference. There is one of the game options. You have to kill a wizard. And that is the win criteria. And in another one, you have to find the Holy Grail before you escape, I think is another one. And that is essentially it. You don't really know why you are imprisoned in a tower or how you got into the tower. The manual doesn't frame any kind of story at all. It just says that you need to think about this and you need to find treasure, and it will give you points, but it doesn't give you any kind of context at all. And I think that really is my first issue with this. Now, look, let's get this out the way right from the top. I can appreciate this game, but I really, really struggled with it and struggled really to have any fun whilst playing it. And I'm going to try and articulate as we go through why some of the things that I didn't like. But I think the first thing I struggled with is the fact that I struggle with games where it doesn't feel like there's a point to what you're doing. And that is a big thing with Tower of Doom.
Yeah, it's an exercise in, it's a puzzle game. It's basically saying, here's a different, like, puzzles.
Every game's a puzzle game, of course.
Yeah, even Doom is, actually, especially Doom. That's a whole different conversation, but the point being is that there isn't a point in this. There is no beginning. Well, there is a beginning, middle, end, but there's no motivation other than just to get out. And it's a bit strange, but that's you could argue Elder Scrolls has that. Elder Scrolls has you starting in a prison a lot of the time.
Yeah.
I know Oblivion did. I know Skyrim did, actually, thinking about it.
Did Skyrim start like that, yeah.
Yeah, although you wake up in the back of a cart and you're about to be executed. It's not quite the same thing, but anyway.
Yeah.
It's not an Elder Scrolls game, far from it. What it is an exercise in just, here's the dungeon crawl. It's a purist dungeon crawl experience in that you're going down into a dungeon for reasons.
Yeah.
You know, and whereas in modern games, and indeed back then, you could argue that all the other, like Ultima, I mean, that went straight. I mean, everyone knows that Ultima 2 goes into space, for example. Very strange. they are more, you know, they are just motive, all about story and narrative.
But there's world building going on with the likes of Ultima and Wizardry, though.
Whereas in this, they're taking the classical version of Dungeons and Dragons in that, it's a dungeon with dragons in it.
And monsters. And
off you go.
Yeah.
And whereas, you know, 5th edition D&D and that kind of stuff, you can't get away with that so much these days, really, unless it's a board game. So it doesn't really work. So for adventuring for the adventuring's sake, this is what this is about.
Yeah.
Discovery for discovery's sake. Okay. And while I share Chris's concerns about the entertainment value of this game, the reasons for it might be quite different.
Yeah.
You know, because I remember there were contemporary games at the time, like Swords and Sorcery on the Spectrum, and you could argue The Alchemist and stuff like this, and there's Heavy on the Magic is another one. That's what it's up against. And indeed, Ultima and Wizardry and stuff like that. It couldn't, you know, the machine could only do so much.
Yeah.
I mean, what they managed to get to do was impressive.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, it doesn't. What I know it can do, the design of this, the underlying design of this game is flawed. And I know, we know why, because it never really couldn't be finished properly.
Yeah.
They had a large amount of resources working on it previously.
Yeah.
Then another company with much less resources came in.
Yeah.
Said, let's just finish this off. But not really understanding that actually you can't just finish it off because it's not, I generally get the impression that this game is about 80% done.
Yeah, it does feel that way.
It's undercooked. It really is undercooked.
Yeah.
There's not enough. There's so much they could have done.
It doesn't resolve.
Not to. No.
Like it doesn't resolve. It doesn't go anywhere. I think that's my problem with it.
The only, like I said, the only challenge I got was like trying to defeat the dungeon, trying to get through and get, and it's quite interesting when you encounter new monsters. That's all really fun.
Yeah.
Oh, what's that thing? Oh, it's just ripped my face off.
Oh, I'm
what's
dead.
What's that thing? Oh, I'm
yeah.
dead.
Yeah.
You know, but there are aspects to it, but I think we're kind of dancing around the main engine of the game.
Yeah.
And I'd like to, would you mind if I delved into that?
Do it.
And then, or do you want to?
No, do it.
So it's presented in a screen with four segments.
Yes.
So the first, in the top left-hand corner, you have the mini-map, which is vital.
Yeah.
So you need that, otherwise you don't know where you are. Without that, the game would be rubbish. And this is very similar to the first game, Cloudy Mountain, which I highly recommend you play that over this, believe it or not. And then the other screen on the right hand side, top right hand side corner, is where the main action occurs, where your most attention is derived at. You're focused on this more than anything. It's where you're moving around a randomly generated, procedurally generated map.
They're not all procedurally generated, are they? Some of them are.
Some of them are. Some of them aren't.
Yeah. The two easiest adventures are the same each time. But yeah,
same
you're right.
Time.
Most of them are.
And it kind of works. It's not Diablo, but then again, you know, it's not that.
No.
But anyway, at least they tried. So that's go Fog of War. So you move around, you can't see the passages until you approach them, and then it opens up.
Yeah.
In theory. And then immediately below that is a blank bar. You can't see anything on it.
Yeah.
Just a blank bar, but it's a space.
Yeah.
Go,
yeah, it's intriguing. It's a pregnant space.
It's a pregnant space. Like, it's like, why is that? You know, space is premium on these machines. Why have they let it blank? Well, it's not blank.
No.
That's actually a space for text.
Yes.
So you have to conjure it, you have to trigger it.
Yeah.
So that's fine. But then back over on the left, there's another little box underneath your mini map, and that is your inventory.
Yeah.
Now, who here, hands up when you're in the car or whatever, please don't do that. Stay with hands on the wheel. But just do a nod and gesture and say, who's played first Mass Effect? I'm sure you have. Right. So you thought the inventory of that game was terrible, right? Totally. Well, there's nothing compared to this mess.
Yes.
Absolute shocker.
Now,
tried.
What do you think? Okay, so let's talk about that then. So
Yeah.
What is it that you don't like about the inventory?
It's the need. It's so limited. It gets full very, very, very quickly.
It does.
And when you drop something, you're going to have to drop something.
Yeah.
The game has it so it automatically picks things up.
Yes.
So the amount of times I found myself going, I want that mace. Really want that mace. But I've got too many things I don't need. So I'm going to drop this staff here.
No, you're not.
I'm going to drop that. Okay, I've dropped it. Oh, no, I'm being attacked. Okay, well, hang on. Okay, okay. So I'll run out. Oh, no, I picked up a boot. I don't want the boots. Really? Okay, and I've got to drop the boot. Oh, no, I'm in attack.
You're too close to a wall. You can't drop the boots.
No, yes, exactly. It's just.
Yeah.
It's just. Oh, God.
I mean,
when you pick up treasure, you've got to. It doesn't tell you this.
No.
But you have to use the treasure to level up.
Yeah.
Doesn't tell you that. And I was watching a video of someone doing this, and they picked it up and thought that treasure had to be kept in. Like, they were just struggling, like, oh no, I can't drop the crown. Like, use the crown.
Yeah, you do.
Use it, and then you'll get level up. That's how it works.
Yeah.
But yeah, I it was pretty bad. It's pretty excruciating. And that menu over on the left hand side is critical to the game. If you don't know how to use it, you're stuffed. You're absolutely stuffed.
Yeah.
And it doesn't explain how to use it.
I'm going to be kind to it.
And say
it's unintuitive.
Yes, that's true. It is.
And that's probably at best. At worst, it is terrible. The fact that you have a limited inventory, fine. You know, fine. That adds a challenge. Because you're constantly making decisions about, right, there's a mace there, but hang on, I've already got a sword and I've got a dart, I've got a dagger. So do I want that mace? Is it more powerful than the one I've got? So you are constant, and you know, I like that. I like you having to make these decisions. If I pick up that mace, it means I'm going to have to sell a treasure. Now, you do get points when you move from floor to floor with treasures in your inventory. You do get, and this is where I think the game is woefully inadequate. It doesn't explain itself. I had no idea that you got points from having treasure in your inventory until I read it on Strategy Wiki this morning. You know, and I've probably spent 12 hours playing this game. I had no idea that happened, but it does. But you are having to make the judgment call. Right, do I sell that now? Do I take that potion now so I can pick up the mace? That's good. I like that.
Yeah.
It's making me think and it's giving me decisions to make.
But I just want to level up. So I was like, any treasure, I'll just cash the ink. So I'll just, no. The premium of space in that bloody bag of mine, like, if you're not a weapon or a bit of food.
Yeah, you are.
Get off.
You are being used.
Get off. You're being used. And that's, you know, that's lovely. And that's there's layers to this game. And it wants to be more than it is.
But
changing, could have just spent a little more time, you know.
Yeah. A little bit of refinement. Changing weapons though.
Oh.
I mean, if you mean, because you're constantly you're constantly harassed by the enemies patrol around the dungeon. Some of them are in fixed locations, but a lot of them will move around. So if you idle, then you will end up being attacked and you will enter the combat mode where the view changes from this sort of strange overhead perspective, overhead but not, to a 2D kind of plane.
Side view.
Yeah, combat side view, 2D plane. You can move forwards
and backwards. Don't get excited. It's not Street Fighter. You don't suddenly break into a Street Fighter game. No, that'd be weird.
It's not Street Fighter at all. No. And from there, you need to attack and you need to have a weapon equipped or you will come onto that. But if you are in your inventory, which is likely because you'll spend a long time fighting with the inventory, trying to drop things, trying to sell things. Yep. If you just happen to be in your inventory when you are attacked, you get very little warning of this stuff. And then you are fiddling around trying to put a weapon into your hand. So you can attack.
Yeah.
And I can guarantee you will have lost hit points by the time you have managed to achieve this seemingly simple thing, such as holding a weapon. Now, one thing I would say is that you get used to it. And the more you play it, the quicker. Now, I would never say it becomes intuitive because it's simply not intuitive, but you do get used to it and you get quicker. And I imagine for those who've played a lot of this, I probably would say, probably think to themselves, what's all the fuss about? You know, you just practice and then you get used to it. That's fine. I'm not sure a lot of people would ever get that far though, because I think a lot of people will bounce off this simply because the inventory is so cumbersome to navigate through. And I think it really holds it back.
It does, but it's a thing you get used to very quickly.
We're you being do very get used negative. To it. You do.
It's annoying that we have to get used to it, but you do get used to it.
Yeah.
And then once you then start getting used to all these things, there's one final thing we need to talk about. It's very important. Is your health.
Yes.
Now, you've only got one life, okay? You can't respawn or anything like that. Once you die, that's it. It's a rogue game, everyone. So. Yeah.
And that's also displayed on screen.
It is. And it's a series of shields.
Yeah.
Sometimes there's a black sort of bar behind those shields, which I believe represents your maximum health.
Yes.
And this can grow. This black bar can grow faster than your health can.
Yeah.
Because you can level up. And when you level up, you get more health points.
Potions.
Or potential health points with potions. Oh, there's a potion where you get, and one of them says, I have the power.
Yeah, yeah.
At which point you then immediately have to raise your arm up and sort of like run across.
And then a strange tiger thing.
Yeah, strange tiger thing, which existed only because they had a very large tiger compared to the man model, and they've just painted it green with orange stripes. It's fine.
Yeah,
that's a real story. That really happened, everyone. That's how Battle Cat came to be. And it's so that mechanic I quite liked. It's very easy. It's very prominent. You could look down in it relatively quickly. The way I have my setup for my PS2, because I did. I know Chris and I, we both played this on internet, in television lives.
Yep.
On the PS2. So we were playing a retro collection.
Yeah.
On what is divisive to say a potentially retro console. I know. There's people outside immediately. I've said that there with torches and
I can
and
see them.
Pitchforks.
They're out there with their.
I can see them with their
placards and their t-shirts.
Yeah. Down with this sort of thing. Careful now.
My mind is blown.
It's just, but anyway. So we were playing it on that machine. So it's because the game itself is quite rare, but we'll talk about it later on. But the point is, it was really prominent, really well designed. The actual layout and everything else is very easy to get into. It really is to see. It's very obvious what's going on to a point once you start reading it. Mm. And when you say reading it, you read what the state of things are, and also the instructions. You have to read them over and over. There's lots of little quips and little tiny little like, hints about what's going on. Really, like there's the sound was it's got a go approach here, but the sound is a bit odd because all you can hear is your bloody heartbeat.
Yeah. I've never really got to grips with that. Now, what the manual says, that sound is very important because some spells are linked to your heartbeat. And if you try and pass through certain traps whilst your heart is beating or not beating, then... Or someone said that... I read somewhere that if there is a sound playing, there's a bug in the code, which means if there is a sound playing, you can get through traps...
Yeah,
they won't activate. So if you sell a treasure and you get that little sting, you can then run through a trap. But to be honest with you, I mean, that heartbeat actually got quite annoying after a while.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's not like... I'm not sure if it changes. I think it does, but I couldn't tell.
No.
Because it's not like Populous, the Amiga version.
Where, no.
You know, that goes up.
And yeah, exactly, yeah.
That as you, that, whereas this, it just seems to thud along all the time. It's very strange. And it's just, I don't know, it's almost sort of trance-like, it's sort of thudding along. But, yeah, it's the sound is nowhere near as good as the first game. See what I mean?
Mm.
If you want sound engineering or demonstration of sound design, play the first game.
But you get the feeling, and the manual's woefully inadequate because it doesn't. It explains some of the basics, but very little of... Actually, I think what a lot of people who like this game say what makes it great, and that is the depth of the systems going on in the background. Well, that's fine, but there needs to be either a diegetic way or a thing that you can read. You shouldn't have to go to Strategy Wiki to work out how to play a game. It should be apparent from the manual. A game like this should have a comprehensive manual. The manual talks about sound, but it doesn't tell you anything other than sound is important. Go figure it out. Now, I don't mind games that don't hold my hand. I like old school game design. I play old games because of that. I'm playing Metroid at the moment on original hardware without any save states, and I really, really enjoy it. But I never don't feel as if I'm in any doubt over what to do. I might not know how to do it or where to go, but with this game, I felt like there was just so much it didn't explain. We will talk about colours in a second because colours is absolutely crucial to play in this game. But it kind of says, right, colours are important. Go figure it out. Fine. Give me a clue. Tell me how I can at least try. How do I approach this?
Yeah, I mean, the fact that you got to read the manual for the previous game to know what the colours mean is a bit galling.
It's just ridiculous. Well, given it was 4 years, 5 years,
it's just
nonsense.
But they do match the colours. Basically, what we're talking about the colours here, everyone, is the items you pick up in the maze, in the dungeons and stuff, the equipment, can break in true Zelda Breath of the Wild style.
It's only the ranged weapons that can break, isn't it?
No, you can. Well, some weapons you can throw and use as melee.
Yeah.
And if you throw them, then they start to break.
That's correct.
If you keep using them as melee, they still break, but it takes longer to do,
okay.
As I understand. I did notice that weapons I was using only in melee were still breaking.
Yeah.
So, But there, I mean, some of the weapons are like, there's the wand. Just don't, no, don't use that, because it bounces back on you and kills you. It's just awful.
As does the blast radius from the wonderfully named holy hand grenade. Also, yes, can kill you as well.
It can. But I did love that weapon though. It's great.
Yeah,
it's good. Yeah. But that's, there's more to talk about that. But let's talk about these traps though.
Yeah,
fucking traps.
So around the dungeons are traps, some traps, which is fine, and they are displayed on screen by some kind of indicator.
Mm.
Now, the traps range from the obvious. There is what is very obvious. There's a transport, and it's very obvious. It's a transport. It looks. You think to yourself, right? If I go into that, I'm going to be. It's a portal. I'm going to be whisked away somewhere. That is exactly what happens. You are taken to a different location on your current tower level. Could be helpful. Could be unhelpful. Paralysis is probably the most annoying of the traps, because that is, I think, again, fairly obvious what it does. You go into it, you freeze. Now the problem with paralysis is that if you don't move away, you don't know when you unfreeze, so you need, and the manual actually says this, you need to keep pushing the direction away from the trap. And what will happen is you will get caught in it again, and you might get caught in it four times. You could be there for a minute before you can finally get away. Confusion is another obvious one. The thing on the screen which signifies the confusion trap, again, it looks fairly obvious what that's going to do, and it's fairly obvious what effect it has when you go into it, because all of a sudden your man's like, it's like your man's drunk. You press left and he moves right, or you press up and he moves down, etc. And that lasts for about 30 seconds. Then you get to the ones which I think are not so good. So there's a trap called Life Eater, which reduces your life force. Now, the problem with the life force, okay, so we haven't talked about life force. See, there's a lot going on here. Life force is essentially, it's like your hunger level. So it's constantly depleting all the time, irrespective of whether or not you've taken damage. If you stood still for enough time, you'd end up, your life force will be completely depleted. Now, Chris, you say that when your life force is depleted, you start losing hit points, you don't instantly die?
No, as far as I understand it, I might have to be corrected on this, but it's a variant of either that, what you just said, or you just stop healing.
Okay.
When you stop, you are automatically healing your hit points.
That's right, very slowly.
Slowly. Or it can be increased by certain potions, and then the rate of healing goes up quite exponentially.
Yeah.
But, that's where how life force works. So it's good to keep, not be hungry.
Yes.
That's what food does. Food doesn't heal you.
Like no, it replenishes your life force.
Which is a different thing to your heals. Now, so your actual health is different to your life force.
To find out what current status your life force is, and it's a number which just ticks down slowly.
It does, yeah.
From about 256, I think it just ticks down, doesn't it? Now, to find out what your life force is and what your other statistics are, including the value of your treasure, you need to go into our old friend, the inventory, and go to one of the icons there, which is essentially a status icon.
It says question mark.
Yeah, it says, yes, question mark, which if you press the question mark, you put the hand on the question mark, and then you cycle through, it'll tell you what your strength is, your
also
stamina.
Also in that dead space that you thought, what's that? There? Suddenly becomes animated.
Yeah, your pregnant space is
filled with text.
With text, and it'll tell you what each of these things are. Mm-hmm. Great. Life Eater, the trap, reduces your life force. Now, the problem is you walk through a trap. You have no idea what's just happened. You get a little bit of sound. In order to find out what's happened, you would need to go into your status, but you wouldn't have known what your life force was before it, because it's not always displayed on screen. So you have no idea what's just happened.
Also, going into inventory is a tricky thing to do in this game.
Exactly. Best avoid it whenever you can.
Yeah, because otherwise that's some monsters trying to chew your face off and stuff.
See, you have no idea what this trap has done. It's the same with fire. Now, fire reduces your hit points, does it?
Because apparently.
I've stood in fire for a good few seconds and nothing's happened.
Nothing happens,
So what? I've really struggled with this. Like, what is happening to me here? The game is trying to tell me something's happening because it's playing a sound when I move through these traps. But there's no real appreciable effect.
No.
And, It was like, give me some feedback, game. You need to tell me what's happening so I can react accordingly. Too often in this game, I was thinking to myself, I don't know what's going on here. Something's going on. I know that, but what?
Yeah. Yeah.
Struggled.
It's a shame. But,
now, some traps, just before we close off on traps, some traps you can get through if you are holding a colour corresponding key.
Yes.
Now, again, I've never really managed to do this because all traps I could get through, okay, confusion might slow me down a little bit or paralysis might, but it doesn't stop you from going through.
Also, paralysis does affect you if you're in the middle of it and then some monster attacks
you. You're practically dead. Yeah, if it's a powerful monster, you're dead.
Yeah, you're probably dead.
Yeah, because you can't move in combat.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Can we just rewind back a few steps? So I think what is important, let's talk about something which I think is positive.
Yeah.
Because there's a lot of stuff here which we're taking issue with.
Yeah.
There is a lot of game here.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
A huge amount of gameplay crammed into this card. So there are 7 different adventures. Each adventure does things slightly different. So, for instance, the easiest adventure is, and this is all set out in the manual, the easiest adventure is called the Novice Adventure. The tower is only 6 levels high or deep, depending on perspective. The maze and the colour, and the next thing we will talk about is colour, we promise. The colours and the order of the colours is the same. The maze is the same each time. And the game describes that as an introduction. The most difficult adventure, according to the manual, is called the Grail Quest. That's set over 32 levels of the tower, 32, with a procedurally generated maze and a randomized order of colors with each game. That is one where you don't have to escape the tower, where you have to find the Grail, and then I think you have to escape the tower, although I could be wrong on that. Now, 32 levels of the tower, you can't save during one life. It's intended to be difficult. Obviously, that's the most difficult. But I played through. So I think the longest one I did was a 12 level. I did the catacombs on 12 level tower. Probably took me about an hour and 20 minutes, hour and 15 minutes. If you times that by 3, that's a long, long time to be sitting doing the same thing, level after level. The only real difference is obviously the maze on each level is different. The value of the treasures goes up, but also the monsters. Every 2 levels, you get introduced to a new monster. Obviously, it gets harder and harder and harder. If you are underprepared, by the time you get down to, say, midway through the tower on those harder games, and you come across a Hydra or God forbid, a dragon, forget about it. That is almost instant death, and you have nothing. You start again. Brutal.
Brutal. That's rogue for you. That's rogue for you.
But what I think the other thing, so there's a lot of game, positive, 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 positive. There is a lot of game here. I mean, if you wanted to, you know, and this is, as Chris said, it's adventuring for adventuring's sake. That's what this game is. It's for the love of the adventure. So if that floats your boat, if that sounds like, you know, I think when this game is described, I think it sounds great. If that sounds good, give this game a go. The problem is there's no continuation of your character.
No, it grows and from then run once to run. Been, well, yeah, but again, I'm going to say it. That would be the catchphrase for this episode. That's rogue. No, that's what it's like. You have a character and it has a whole raft of characters. It's about 16, 11, 12 of them, something like that.
But when was Rogue published?
I can't remember.
1970?
It's a mainframe.
70-something?
Yeah, yeah.
By 1987, if I was playing this game in 1987, I'm pretty sure I would have expected something a little bit more. If it said, right, you create a character and you can take this character on a number, you know, something like Eamon, for instance. You can take this character on a number of different adventures. You've got these 7 adventures to choose from. You can either choose one of our preset characters, which the game provides you with, or you can create your own. And you take this character and you level up and from adventure to adventure and you progress. That changes the whole landscape of this game for me because it gives me a purpose. You know, when I'm selling treasure to get experience, I want to level up because I want to get to level 4 because then all of a sudden I might be able to have a better go at the fortress adventure. But because there's none of that meta progress here.
No.
I've got nothing.
The only thing you've got is experience and playing the game itself. That's the point. So you now know what the risk rewards are. Should I pick that up? Should I trade this treasure in now? Or should I hold on to it until I get out of this level? You know, all that sort of stuff. What's growing is not the data in the machine or the game, but the you as a player.
Yeah.
That's what it's doing. That's what it's throwing back at you. It's like, no, I'm not going to give you any progress, actual tangible progress within the code here. I'm going to throw it back to you and say, you need to get better. And eventually you'll find the challenges in the different dungeons, of which there are many, are going to be a cakewalk, you know. And that's the whole point. It's really challenging you. It's placing this, here's a series of puzzles, you know, solve them. That's it. It's like a Sudoku book. You know, there's a series of those. There's no narrative to those. Well, there might be in some, but you know, it's that's what it really is, and that's what it's sort of laid before you.
Yeah.
And it's very brutal like that, and it's very sort of cold like that. There's nothing more to it. There's no pretense of a story here. It's just you in a dungeon getting out by the best means necessary.
I suppose it's a taste thing, isn't it?
Maybe.
You know, I prefer my adventures with just a little bit of context.
Well, you and I both enjoyed our JRPGs and CRPGs.
Yeah.
You know, I got more out of Baldur's Gate as regards to the story than the actual adventuring.
The mechanics.
Although some of those engagements are pretty cool. But let's talk about that. So that's a subject for another podcast.
Yeah.
But we do need to talk about these colours because we've been mentioning it several times.
One thing before we do, and one thing I think one final thing we ought to mention before we do talk about the colours. We've talked about these preset characters just very briefly.
Oh, yes.
There are, as well as being able to choose your adventure, you can choose from 10 preset characters.
Yeah.
I'll list them very briefly. Novice, warrior, archer, knight, trader, barbarian, waif, friar, warlock, and warlord. What the manual tells you is that the warlord is the strongest and fully equipped to start with, and it's the easiest character to begin with. The waif is, I think he has 1.5 shields of health and a completely empty inventory. So you start from scratch, basically. You have to go and forage for your first weapon. You probably have to bribe the enemies to begin with. I think it starts you off with a couple of low-level treasures so you don't have to fight, because you can choose to bribe enemies. Doesn't always work, but you can, which is another thing this game does well. You don't have to actually swing a sword, although that's not strictly true, because you will die because some enemies can't be bribed, or you wouldn't have the treasure to bribe them. But again, in terms of the amount of game that's here and the options and replayability, you do have all of these different options, which start with different stats, different loadouts to begin with, and you can work your way. You can find out which are the hardest, which are the easiest, and work your way through. So again, lots of replayability, lots of game. It does that really, really well. And you can't create your own character.
No, you cannot. So you won't be spending hours doing that.
You can't have everything.
No.
Right. Colors. The leash is off. Chris, I'm in your capable hands. Tell us what the blinking hell is going on with these colours.
So they were really about quality. They're demonstrating, because this is a very limited game graphically. It has to be, because it's on Intellivision, for pity's sake. So they, you know, typically most sprites only have one colour on them. So the way they deal with it and the equipment that you find is they all have a colour, and this colour represents their quality in terms of, when it comes to weapons, their durability, and when it comes to other items, their effect.
Yeah.
So for weapons, the scale is from typically, he says delicately, typically, the least quality is grey, Then it goes to cyan, then orange, then brown, pink, lavender, apparently, which is kind of purple, really, bright green, and magenta. And magenta's the ones you want, all green ones, bright green ones. So it doesn't follow the World of Warcraft sort of quality thing where orange is number one, then purple, then blue, then green. Doesn't follow that. It does a completely different. And you have to sort of basically understand this. So you pretty much figure out, because when things go grey, you know that's going to disappear at some point.
Yeah.
That is going to disappear. And that's basically it in regards to weapons. So that's fine. But when it comes to things like items, mm-hmm. their different colours mean different things entirely. So, I think a pink potion is very bad. I think it freezes you.
Typically.
A yellow scroll, which I think, was an orange scroll I think I picked up once. That summoned an Eye of Beholder.
Yeah.
That didn't end well.
That's death. Me.
Really? Yeah. I mean, I didn't die, but I may as well have been because I was down to one health after that engagement. But that's really how the game communicates to you the very important stats of an item. There's no numbers here. The only numbers are about you.
Yeah.
Everything else is just, you know, figure it out, I guess, try to read what the situation.
Yeah.
Based on sound and color and movement. But you don't know that. You don't know how much health the enemies have when you're attacking them. There's no health bars and stuff. Well, no. Don't be silly. They're just either dead or not.
Yeah.
Or alive or dead.
Yeah.
And you don't know, you have no idea the potency of the enemies that you face, other than they might be slightly bigger.
Yeah, and you know. The deeper down the tower you go, generally. If you come across something you've never come across before, it's going to be more powerful than anything else you've faced.
When I got mauled by an owlbear, that was a bit, you know.
Yeah, you mean that's going to happen.
That's going to happen.
But the one thing it does, at least, again, in its favour, So the manual, again, woefully inadequate. There's about three paragraphs on this stuff. And it basically says the only way to find out whether something's good or bad is just to try it. Fair enough. Absolutely fair enough. And what the game does is if on level one you find a yellow potion or an orange potion and you try and it does something good, all orange potions throughout the game are going to do good things equally. And those effects, some last for a short time, some last the whole level on the tower, some last the whole game, the whole adventure. Now, that sometimes it's obvious because if you've got a potion that maxes out your HP, it's obvious because your shields are filled up. If you've got a potion that increases your strength stats by 5, less obvious unless you want to battle with the inventory. But every time you see a potion of that color, you know, that's a good potion. And on most of the adventures, the order of the colours is the same. So if you know that orange potions are good, and so on half of the adventures, if you know that an orange potion is good, and over time you've worked out orange potion is good, on 3 of the 7 adventures, it's going to be good in every adventure. So you're fine. You're on solid, solid ground. On 4 of the adventures, the colour order of what's good and what's bad is changed. Now, it's not randomised because the way these things are stored in memory means that you will always get the same order. So if you knew orange was good, brown is bad, and then you start a new adventure and all of a sudden orange is bad, you know brown is going to be good because they're next to each other. And again, this is all taken from the strategy wiki guide, which I think is pretty essential reading for someone who doesn't want to spend 20 hours having to figure all this stuff out. But there is a consistency there, but the game is so bad at telling you what is going on in the background. A lot of the time I'd take a potion and it would say something like, or, you know, you'd use a magical artifact. There's magical artifacts as well, like a cloak or a ring.
Oh, yeah, it does this. Go on.
So you'd use a cloak and it will say something like, you are cursed. Okay, cool. How am I cursed? Yeah.
And then worse still, it says, you feel better.
You feel better, or you have the power. Okay, brilliant. Tell me, in what way do I have the power?
In what way?
Yeah.
What
does that mean?
Yeah, and it ultimately, nothing.
What you know, does it mean? This probably happened to you, but I think I used a magical artifact and it said, you are cursed. And I kept getting attacked by things I couldn't see.
Because they're invisible monsters, yeah.
Yeah, I'm seeing invisible monsters. And yeah, I did not know, because the manual doesn't tell you what the possible consequences are, I was blind.
No.
I couldn't see the monster.
Also, there was also, I took a potion and I became invisible. That was fun.
Now, that is fun. But again, you wouldn't have known until you said, well, hang on, why aren't these things following me? What's happening?
Yeah. Yeah, I had to look at my mini-map to see where I was. It's funny.
But if the game...
Yeah, I genuinely believe that, you know, we're kind of coming up to a summary point here, and I'm aware of, but the lack of information, some games get away with it of this era. That's fine. Wizardry got away with it. Ultima definitely got away with it. But then they had a broader depth to them because they could, because the machines they're running on were just, you know, much more powerful and had a lot more going for them. And they could pull these things off. And you could argue some of the 8-bit computers had better, broader sort of, you know, Swords and Sorcerer point looking at you and the other games I mentioned earlier in this show.
Yeah.
They had broader depth to them and had stories and stuff like this. And they couldn't really do this in this game. And Swords and Serpents on the Intellivision as well. It's similar, it suffers from a similar fate. It's just adventure into adventure in sake. But it's the lexicon of the game is so hard to fathom.
Yeah.
And it's so impenetrable that most people are going to bounce off of this. Yeah. And I would, if you want to play a really good dungeon crawler on the Intellivision, and that's not, it's a very strange sort of scenario to talk about, but there is Venture as well. Mm. So there's three, basically, I think. There's four if you include this one. Mm. I would say the first two D&D games are the ones you should be playing.
Yeah.
This one didn't cut the mustard for me because I loved the first two so much.
Yeah.
That this one, basically, like I said early on in the show, it took the best bits of those two. I say it took my best bits, put bits from those two and tried to mash them together and turn it into this. And I don't think it works because they're so different games. Try to merge the two is folly. They should have done, I don't know what they should have done, you know, but this is, what they should have done is carried on baking away at this because it wasn't finished.
Yeah.
The claim is made, it's finished. I do not believe it is.
Yeah, they've missed the boat already, haven't they? What's the point in rushing it out?
Yeah, they could have done more with it because there's a lot of content.
It's a huge amount of game.
There's so many monsters, so many. In fact, I recognise all of them, the shape of them. I recognise them from the books I have in my cupboard right now.
Are the images of the monsters not IP protected?
You'd think, wouldn't you? But they are very similar to, there's definitely the flying sort of like blood-sucking bat thing.
Yeah.
That's because that I'm like, wow, that really looks like, you know, a giant stag beetle as well. And the scorpions, they're huge. They're huge, way bigger than the one in Pitfall. I can assure you that.
Manual doesn't name them, does it? But the imagery is familiar.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. Yeah.
Just before we sum up, in terms of reception, I mean, there weren't any Intellivision magazines around in 1987, and I couldn't find a review from any of the multi-formats that were around at the time. Did anyone care about Intellivision games released in 1987? I'm sure some people did. I couldn't find any sales figures, so I just don't know. I can't imagine this game sold massively, which is probably why it's so blooming expensive today.
Yeah. I remember Silica Shop selling it.
Okay.
I don't know what Silica Shop is. Of course you do, everyone.
I don't know what Silica Shop is.
No, Silica Shop. Look it up. They were a reseller of Intellivision and Atari ST and Amiga stuff.
Okay.
For quite a
CEX of their day?
Yeah, but they didn't trade in anything. But they did sell all the computer hardware. Silica Shop, they had a store in Tottenham Court Road.
Okay.
But they were based in, I think they had a store in Sidcup or something like that, I remember. But they were very large and they were very prominent in the 80s and early 90s, up to mid-90s, before that scene faded away. And they tried to move on to PCs, but it didn't work out for them in the end. Mm. But they sold this, I remember, because I had a catalogue of theirs and they sold this. And I still had an Intellivision, as I had. I still don't have my original Intellivision because that died but I did have an interest in it. But I remember them selling copies of this and Commando,
yeah,
for a bundle, and I wasn't interested because, you know, I had an ST for heaven's sake. But it's very late in its life, and it shows, because yeah, there's promise there. They really were pulling out things that ought not be from that machine. Don't get me wrong. And some of the, like, the amount of content is just, I don't know how they did it.
Yeah.
I don't know how they did that. Very, very clever in some regards.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, there's just not enough game now, I think. There's a lot of it. For me to say, we've been saying this all the way along. It's a lot, but it's missing.
Yeah. What did you say earlier? That it doesn't explain its lexicon.
No.
I think that's a really good way to sum up the problems I have with this. Is there's a lot there. And CRPG Addict played it. I just want to finish off with this. So CRPG Addict played it, the blogger and writer of the Bitmap Books, book on CRPGs. This is not a CRPG, obviously, because we're talking about the Intellivision, which was a console, but he played it because one of his patron subscribers suggested he did it. So we can't, and he does say his review of it is, he scored it on his matrix that he scores all of his CRPGs against. And it actually came out, and he did say this can't really apply because it's about computer RPGs, and a lot of it is tailored for computer RPGs, but it came up with a score of 21. Now, I'm not a big follower of the blog, so I can't really explain it, but what he did say is that this, of the four RPGs that were released for the second generation consoles, which he played, that score on his sort of objective level came out best. So he didn't love it. He's colorblind, bless him. So I think colorblindness, it would be a huge issue with playing this game. He struggles to distinguish colors when they are next to one another. So that really hampered and would hamper your ability to play this game. But there was a lot in it that he liked. Not a contemporary reviewer, but someone who knows what they're talking about. He found stuff to like. He found stuff he didn't like. A little like us, probably more positive than us. Again, he said that in terms of things to do and as much game there is a lot. There's a lot to enjoy, but having to work your way through 32 levels without the ability to save or pause is a huge barrier to stop players going through the longer challenges.
Yeah, it's the challenge for challenge's sake, like I said.
Yeah.
That's what we always are about.
You've kind of been summing up your thoughts. Have you got any other closing remarks, anything else you'd like to say about Tower of Doom?
I think it's an interesting addition to the pantheon of games on the Intellivision. I think it's worthy of attention. I think it's something it should be experienced. I don't want to shy away, but we're going to say but it's not. I don't think it's the classic that many people put it up to be, in my opinion, after playing it for quite some time. I'd much rather spend my time on something more engaging than it, because that ultimately was it. It was like, what is it? It just felt like an absolute exercise in futility. You could argue it's the same for Robotron, but that would be heresy. But there's similes between them. You know, that game doesn't end and it becomes a war of attrition. But that's not to its detriment. Whereas in this, it's just like, am I going to survive? I don't know. Oh, wait, that's not fair. And that's the problem. You know, it breaks the rule of never being unfair, when in fact it is unfair in many regards.
Yeah, well said. For me, all of this stuff is objective. Of course, we all have different opinions. One of my biggest struggles with it was a lack of context, a lack of overall purpose, a lack of continuity from one game to the next. I have no problem with games that have challenging old school systems, which ask a lot of you, which demand that you read the manual several times, which require you to have patience. I don't have any problem with dying, but what I do expect is, I expect the game to speak to me and to tell me what is happening. I think the moment when I have to start looking at YouTube videos or FAQs to not just to beat the game or to master the game, but to simply enjoy it on its basic level, I think there is a problem there in its design for me. Every time I read something about this game or watched a YouTube video, I went back to it afterwards, because when people talk about the game and when I read something about the game, it's much more interesting and more enjoyable, actually, than the moment-to-moment experience of playing it. When you're in a bind and you're trying to drop that treasure so you can pick up your bow and arrow to replace the one that's just broken, but you can't drop your treasure because you're too close to a wall and you need to find a big room to drop it in, the frustration grows and grows and grows. And I think this demands patience, like probably like unlike any game that I've played before. Maybe if you can get through that ceiling and you can overcome the frustrations and you can ride through the patience, you will get to a point where you can enjoy this, because there's a huge amount of game. But this game was published in 1987. That is a year after Zelda and Metroid were published. And that, for me, is a big, big problem for it. I think it had this game released in 1983-84, who knows? I still don't think it would have been my cup of tea even had played it then, not to mention the fact that it was only had been two or three. But I think in 1987, the game feels woefully out of date. But the Intellivision is a system full of charm and character, and I'm glad we were able to experience it.
Yeah, yeah. I it's a fine addition, as I've said, and I agree with what you say, and that it's a little bit impenetrable. And it wasn't my personal choice, as everyone knows. I still would have liked to have gone down.
I take that blame.
I would have liked. I mean, don't, you know, that show, have a play of Whitewater if you can. Try and,
yeah.
It's harder to get older than this one, which would have been another reason why it may not have been a great selection. But be that as it may, or, yeah, I think I've said enough. It's a great. It's an interesting game. I was about to say great. It's not. It's an interesting game. But do your research if you want to delve into it.
The great thing about it is that it's got you back on the podcast, and that has been a pleasure and an honour for me personally to record with you, Chris. It's great to have your voice back on RA, and I really hope that we can get you back on later in the year and do something else. It's been great to have you back.
No, it's been an absolute pleasure. And we shall now draw this to Chris episode as opposed to two doctors.
Chris Squared.
Chris Squared. Like the CD-ROM ROM. The PC Engine.
The Super Chris.
Yeah.
Just before we sign off, you can find Retro Asylum at www.retroasylum.com. We're in all the spaces, Twitters, Facebooks. Patreon, don't forget that, patreon.com/retroasylum or the Retro Asylum, I can't quite remember. Do leave us Apple Podcast reviews on your platforms of choice. We have had a couple recently after not having any for months. They're always appreciated. Come and join us on Discord, links on the website. Hit us up on Twitter if you want an invite. We'll get one over to you. And Mr. O'Regan, thank you very much for your company. And
it's been a pleasure. If you want to hear more about dulcet tones,
you tell us. Tell us where we can find you.
Yeah, caneandrinse.com, all one word. There's an S in rinse, by the way, not a C.
Yeah.
And I do the Sausage Factory weekly podcast where I interview game developers about them and the games they make. And we also do the Cane and Rinse show itself, which is a book club for video games. You might have heard of that concept before. I don't. But that's all cracking on, and we've got some really, really great episodes coming up on that soon. I'm also looking to do the console special, the nature of which I have to keep quiet for now, but look out for that.
Yeah, good man, Chris. Until next time, thank you very much,
and thank you.
I will be back with Matt next month to look at some SNES run and gun games. Until then, bye bye.
From now on, unlike your parents were, you are the secret force of Retro Asylum.
Playing so fast, they're the only ones who can take you back in time. They play old games, they're more retro than J1 Optimus Prime. At home or the arcade for adventures.